Welcome to the TeacherCast Educational Network, coming to you from the TeacherCast studios since 2011. Join us each week as we bring you the latest educational news, EdTech updates, and hottest interviews with today's most influential leaders in education. And now, for your host, Jeff Bradbury.
Hello and welcome to the TeacherCast Educational Network. My name is Jeff Bradbury and welcome to the Jeff Bradbury Show. On today's episode, we're going to be talking to a speaker, author, and presenter all about how he has made his name in the field of public speaking and how you can do it too. We're going to be talking about how to create a proposal, how to choose the right session names, and how you can make a memorable conference presentation. So stick around for a fantastic episode. Hope you guys have had a chance recently to check out the brand new teachercast.net. We got a lot of great content, blogs, audio shows, and we're even starting to put up some of our online courses over at teachercastuniversity.com. Check out all the great work over on teachercast.net today. My guest today is a speaker, author, educator, AI expert, and a fantastic person to talk to. I want to bring on today Mr. Carl Hooker. Carl, how are you today? Welcome to TeacherCast.
Thank you, Jeff, my friend. So good to be here. Thank you for having me on TeacherCast.
I am excited to have you on. I can't believe it's been 13 years and I've never actually had you on the show. Dude, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. 13 years, you know, that's Taylor's lucky number. You know, we were just talking about her pre-show. We were just having a deep conversation about the double album, Jeff. But it's been a while. But you and I have connected over the years on little snippets. You know, we've seen each other kind of in passing, ships in the night, and a little bit on the socials. But great to be here and actually get to know you and get to talk to you. I feel like we've run some similar paths and tracks, although I am currently not teaching middle school like you are, which is a brave new world. But my friend Steve Dembo, I don't know if you know Dembo. Similar.
We got together.
Yeah. You were part of the. So my wife was in that crowd too. You were part of the big ISTE COVID group. My wife was in that group too. But he was another one. He did a lot of traveling and speaking, and then he went back into the classroom because he was just done with it. He was almost burnt out with it. So always good. And I always bounce ideas off of him and ask him, like, why did you decide to kind of go back into the classroom? And the speaking thing is, you know, it's a roller coaster.
Well, talk to us a little bit about that, because, you know, I want to ask you a bunch of questions today about that. It is ISTE season. Many of us are looking forward to that. And just as many of us are looking forward to ISTE, there are like three times as many who are sitting here scratching our head. Before we get into, you know, the proposals and stuff like that, talk to us a little bit about your background. This is something I've always been curious about. This is going to be a weird question here. How did you become Carl Hooker? Like, how did you go from, because you used to teach younger grades, didn't you?
Yeah. So it started when my mom met my dad. No. I'll speed up a little bit further.
Hold on.
The original Mr. Hooker, which was, yeah. There we go. That's called a wrap up for time, folks. So we've got, I started out as a first grade teacher. Yeah, I actually was trying to be an engineer when I went to college here at University of Texas in Austin, which is where I'm based out of. And it was way too much of a black and white thing. I was like, I can't, this profession is not meant for me. So I switched to the most opposite thing I could think of, which was drama, actually. So I spent a year as a drama major and realized quickly that I had a face made for podcasts. And not video podcasts either. So I thought, I bet this isn't going to really help me much. So I was like, I better come to something else. So I came in, my mom was an elementary teacher. So I decided to do elementary education, older grades, usually like middle school, fourth, fifth, and got thrown into a classroom with a bunch of 6-year-olds one year because I was the lowest person on the totem pole. And you know how that works in districts when it's like, oh, you have the least amount of seniority. We're going to throw you wherever we can throw you. And I loved it. I love teaching first graders. And so I stuck with that the longest out of all my positions and then moved around a little bit. I had a teacher that was trying, a principal was trying to kind of invigorate a school on the east side of town, which is a pretty rough kind of underserved community, but they also very low economic. And that school itself had gone through a lot of hard times. And so with leadership, especially. So she said, do you want to come with me? I'm taking three or four staff with me and you're one of them. What do you want to do? And I was like, I mean, I kind of like this computer internet thing. This is 2003, mind you. I was like, maybe we could do like a computer lab. I could teach like the pre-K, the 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds all the way to the 6th graders. And I could teach the parents after school. And so I did. She said, let me set up my lab. Let me set up my rotations. We just built it from scratch. And then from there, I just kind of fell in love and moved around a lot here in the Austin area. I kept moving my way up and eventually ended up as a director of innovation and digital learning, which was a title that I created for myself. Changed my business cards, changed my email signature, and got in trouble 3 months later by my superintendent when she found out that I had changed my title. And I realized later that required board action. But if you know anything about me, I am always a big believer of asking for forgiveness, not permission. So that was pretty much a hint of the times to come with her. But I spent 13 years in that administrative role. Started the first one-to-one iPad program in the state of Texas, K to 12. So we had about 8,000 students. And then that kind of put me on the map in terms of I really started falling in love with doing professional learning, teaching adults, you know. And I don't know how you feel about this, Jeff, but the whole differences between pedagogy and andragogy, you know, the teaching of children versus the teaching of adults. Yeah. And I think there's some pretty big differences, but I've had long debates with friends of mine about, nope, it's kind of the same thing. And I was like, I mean, parts of it. I don't know where you fall on that, but I think,
you know,
what do you think?
I've often said, and this is the music teacher coming out of me, right? I've often said there's no difference between adults and children. They're just taller and smaller. Meaning, if you're going to be with a 4th grade group of orchestra students, you're teaching notes, rhythm, and you know, phrasing. If you're with the, you know, New York Philharmonic, you're still teaching notes, rhythm, and phrasing. You're using different terminology. So yeah. I kind of agree with you on both of those accounts, because when I teach a middle school class or an ISTE session, you still have a beginning and a middle and an end and an anticipatory, you know, you still have the same structure, but clearly you're doing it from a different point of view.
Yeah. And my argument was always that, you know, adults come with more baggage. Don't get me wrong. Kids come with a lot of baggage too. We know that. And they have the emotional, like you're dealing right now in middle school with the hormonal part of that too. I mean, you don't have to deal with that with adults quite as much, but there is a lot of baggage.
Making out before the ISTE sessions.
I don't catch that very often. You don't see that very often, but there is a lot of, you know, just kind of psychology of failure, of not being able to do things the right way, or this feeling, especially in our field where you can't do something technically. So you're feeling like, I'm just not very tech savvy. So I go into a session with a presumption that I'm just not going to get this. And the first time something messes up and the internet doesn't load fast enough, see, it just never works, right? And so then you've got to kind of bring them back in. So for me, when I started kind of playing in that field later on in my career, I really just fell in love with it. I don't know why, but I couldn't wait till my next PD session. And it was usually just in my district. I mean, that's how I started, was just doing, I'm going to try this, I'm going to do this. And I want to really excite and get teachers to try new things. It's kind of like the work you do with coaching, right? It's you want to push them, but you also want to be there to catch them when they fall. So I'm kind of doing both in that role.
And so at some point you made that transition away from being a classroom or a K to 12 person. And you've been presenting for a while, haven't you?
Yeah. 2013, I would say, is when I started in earnest. So that was 11 years ago. I worked for a company called EdTech Teacher, which I think you might be familiar with, out of Boston. Yeah. They had seen me doing some workshops. I kept putting in to do sessions everywhere, ISTE, anywhere I could go, tech and learning. Every time there was some sort of event, I was like, I'm going to put in my name here in Texas. TCA is a big one. And so I was like, I just want practice and just keep doing it. And again, I got the charge from doing it, the creative energy from doing it. And so it turns out someone saw me doing a session and said, hey, do you want to come do some side work for us in the summer? And I was like, oh, I can get, yeah, I get paid for this. I mean, this is amazing. I mean, I already love it, but you're going to pay me to do it? And they're like, yeah, we'll pay a little bit and figure it out. And so a couple of years of doing that made me realize and give me the confidence that thought, okay, I can do this on my own. I don't need to necessarily work for a company, but I can do this on my own, just kind of catch as you can work on the side. Because again, I'm working full time at this point. So for me, it was like, you know, very light getting started a few times. You know, you have to be careful too about balancing your everyday work and taking time off and then the struggles of what happens behind the scenes with organizational jealousy and just kind of the pressure of always having to be ever present. And so like I would be doing a keynote and have a parent complaint in the district. And so I'd get off stage, my phone ringing and my superintendent's like, hey, there's a parent, you got to deal with this technology thing. So I like instantly you're on again, even though I'm taking the time off, right? You're never off, right? You never know this from your previous work too, right? You're on 24/7. And so it's a lot to do both. I'll just say that. And kudos to those that do it. And it took a lot for me to leave too, because I don't want to leave that authenticity and that the reality of being in the space anymore. That's the thing I get worried with the most, actually, of not being there full time right now, is that, if I'm being honest, it's not about the money, it's not about the headaches, it's not about any of that. It's about me not feeling like I'm a part of it anymore, of like a movement of seeing progression through a district. So that part is kind of sad, but we're not here to talk about that.
Well, you had mentioned getting the reps in, and you know, I was talking to somebody the other day about pre-pandemic reps versus post-pandemic. I mean, you know, I started doing this in 2011, and for a while there wasn't a month that went by in New Jersey that there wasn't some kind of an ed camp or conference or something happening. You know, we were getting reps in almost every single weekend, going out to various places. You know, we had Philly and New York and North Jersey and South Jersey, all these different places. You just don't get that anymore. And there's a lot of people that are out there that are trying to figure out, how can you get noticed? How can you start to do all that stuff? One of the things that I admire about you that you do better than everybody else is create sessions that create buzz. Right, people are talking about your session. They want to go to your session. I see the stuff's, you know, sold out every time I see you. Or, you know, all the you've got sessions that really are geared up for people. Let's break this down. How do you choose the sessions that you're going to put proposals in for?
So it's a two-part strategy for me, and it goes back to my teaching days. And that is that whenever I was teaching, if ever there was something formulaic or just kind of repetitive, I would get bored with it and my students would get bored with it. So for me, the first part of putting together a session is it something new and exciting that even I'm going to be interested in? Because honestly, that's going to transpose to my attendees in theory, right? They're going to see my excitement, and kind of when things mess up, which I, again, is one of my kind of trademark things, is just taking risks and failing. That's actually good. You know, I look forward to that, not epic proportions, but even just like having simple mistakes, or it's like, whoa, I've never tried this before, let's see what happens. And not all the time do they work, I'll be honest. So that's part of it. And then the second part of that is strategically thinking, okay, what can I do? Again, if I'm an attendee, if I'm coming to this session as myself, watching this guy, me, up on stage or wherever, so like, what am I getting out of this? Like, am I excited? Am I engaged? Am I getting some takeaways? Am I engaging in collaboration with other people in the room? Am I making new connections and contacts? And so most of the sessions are geared toward that kind of energy. It doesn't really matter the topic, whether right now it's AI, but before that it was, you know, risk-taking and failure. And before that it was mobile learning with one-to-one devices or whatever it was. Like, I want to keep that kind of continual momentum going in a session. And then I can kind of replace it with other types of catchy things. So like the EdTech lip sync battle based on, guess what? The lip sync battle show with LL Cool J, or Nailed It, which is my EdTech version of the Netflix show Nailed It, with where you have so much time to make some sort of cake or whatever, but now it's like an EdTech creation and you'll have a limited amount of time to do it. So competition, there's always a piece of that in my session. So Leslie Fisher once called my sessions the Hunger Games sessions, because she's like, there's people screaming and yelling, and she's like, we did a session next door to each other, and she had to come over at one point during her sessions, and I'm sorry, but what is all the noise happening over here? I'm like, it's one of my Hunger Games sessions. I mean, it just, again, like you said, it's, you want to get that buzz, but you also want people walking away with an experience. And when you only have 45 minutes or an hour to do it, it is a challenge. I mean, to create that, I've created events that last 3 days, you know, iPad Palooza being the biggest one that I did here for 3 days with 1,000 people. And those, I mean, creating experiences, I still have a list of 74 different ideas, Jeff, that I've not done at a conference. And I just keep a running list in my phone at all times of stuff that I want to try.
Now, do you find that you pick a topic and then you figure out how many different variations? I mean, you have the keynote version of this, you've got the Ignite version of this, you got the workshop version of this. And then, like, how do you organize all of that stuff so you're not doing 75 totally different things?
Yeah, there's definitely a core to it. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you're going to have, so if it's AI right now, you know, this is weird though, because like, I will say that all the books I've written, most of those books are written on sessions that I'd done. AI is the first one that was the opposite. AI, I wrote the book with interviews, with webinars, with you know, working with teachers on just their general concerns and ideas. And I built a book around it. And then I started building sessions around that. So it was kind of a backwards design for me. But yeah, generally what I do is I kind of break things into segments. So for me, I'll do a lot of like 5 to 10 minute chunks. So when I'm designing my slides, whether it be a keynote or a workshop, if it's going to be a keynote, then I want to have little 5-minute, 10-minute stories that are kind of interlaced with points and topics based on whatever they want to have. So AI, the AI one I have now, I can do it as anywhere from 5 minutes to about 90 minutes as a keynote. I could do it as a half day to a full day as a workshop, because essentially the differences are I'm going to have some stories still, but now after story comes action. So in a keynote, there may be a little bit of action because you have a few minutes. I like to give the audience a couple minutes to talk and discuss things. But in a workshop, of course, it's going to be like, all right, now you've got 20 minutes. Here's your thing that you have to do, or the topic you have to kind of chew on. And then what are you going to do to create it for yourself? Those kind of things. I give them a chance to play, which is where I always learn a lot too. And I found out, again, late in my teaching career and late in my training career, that the best sessions that I got rated for in my own school district were the ones where I did less talking. So I'm not doing a good example of that on your podcast right now because I'm talking a lot, but backing off, you know, in giving teachers room to play and learn on their own, all the stuff we say to kids all the time, right? Give them a chance to choose their own path. Do they want to learn individually or with a group, or do they want to follow along with what the teachers is doing? So the best workshops I've ever done is where it's a combination of all those. Like, hey, if you want to speed along, here's everything. You can do it all ahead of me and I will not be offended. If you want to wait for me to go step by step, I'm over here doing that, right? So it's content wise, yeah, it's tricky because I do have like 4 pages worth of sessions, but there's a lot of crossover to most of the content. So when I'm rebuilding, I don't always start from scratch. I usually start with a core idea that I've already done, and then I kind of build off of that idea in both directions, if that makes sense.
It certainly does. And you know, you've been presenting long enough and you've got the same sessions over and over again. One of the things that we've talked about here on the channel a lot is this concept of weekday versus weekend professional development, right? Like going to do Carl as an ISTE keynote speech or like that's a different presentation than I'm going to come in on Monday afternoon for your faculty meeting where people have to be there and it's after the long day. But there's also a difference between an ISTE presentation on the weekend and an EdCamp presentation where, you know, smaller group. How do you prepare for each of those? I don't know if you can give an example of, you know, AI. What is the keynote version? What is the EdCamp version? And what is the walking into your student's high school because you're a dad and you want to do a PD? How do you take that topic and break that down 3 different ways so that way it's less work for you, but they still get the same message, but clearly Monday is an ISTE keynote day.
Yeah. Well, and it's internal because it's funny when you were saying that, I was thinking of weekend bourbon and weekday bourbon that I have, which I've seen, like, which is your weekday bourbon? Well, I do bullet on, never mind. That's a different podcast. No, but for me, it's internal. So I try to give myself the same energy level no matter what I'm doing. But that being said, yeah, I trained 12 librarians at a school district recently in a library, and it was just the 12 of them. And so for me, I was like, this is going to be a lot more laid back, a lot more conversational. Even the way I present it is going to come across a lot more laid. I'm going to be in the crowd. I'll be walking around, right? I'm not going to stand at a podium and lecture as much because, again, there's 12 people in a room. I want to hear what they all have to say. I'm going to give them time to have a conversation. I'm going to make them more the stars of the show throughout that day. And I'll do callbacks. So a big thing in comedy, again, this is from going back to my drama days, you know, is callbacks. So whenever someone does something or says something kind of funny, you continue to kind of reference it throughout the day, which makes it kind of a funny little trend. Like I do this thing where I say, what's your, you know, what's the number one song when you turn 14 years old is the song that defines your current reality. Go find what it is and then play it for the person sitting next to you. And then usually that's a good icebreaker. And at the beginning, it doesn't make everyone get up and have to do it. They just have to do it with someone next to them. But what ends up happening is inevitably almost every time somebody does something really silly, like one guy had Baby Got Back, I think was his or something. So the whole rest of the day, and he was embarrassed because it was not definitely his persona, but the whole rest of the day, I called him Sir Mix-a-Lot. And everybody just got it. And he loved it. I mean, he just grew throughout the day. So again, that's a different kind of session versus like a keynote. I did, so I did ASCD, which I've never done this year. I don't know if you've ever been there, Jeff, but I did it, the one in DC. And it was like, I don't know, there's 400 people. I walked into this ballroom. I was like, wow, okay, this is, I thought they're going to stick me in a little room because again, I've never done ASCD. So I walk in and Tom Murray, who's a good friend of mine, was right in front of me and he had done his. And then right after him was, Tom Vander Ark, a big speaker. Oh, Whitaker, Todd Whitaker. That's who it was. He's right after me. And I'm like, man, this is, how do they have me in here? And immediately I'm changing everything in the back of my mind. So, I mean, don't know if you know this, like Martin Luther King, before he gave the I Have a Dream speech, like 5 minutes beforehand, he's changing it. Like the actual I Have a Dream part came up. It wasn't through practice and rehearsal. It was like, oh, I need to change something here. And before he got up on stage, he did it. For me, sometimes I'll think, okay, I need to hook them faster. I need to get them doing something right away to disarm them, because these are leaders in schools that are scared. In this case, the topic was AI, of course. So I'm like, how do I give them something that totally disarms them without them knowing it and making it all AI? So I invented this thing called Karaoke, which I've been doing a lot at some sessions the last couple of months, where it's essentially we just show images on the screen that are AI generated images based on lyrics of a song. And I was like, all right, now talk to your neighbor. What's the song? I'll give you 10 seconds, go. And then they have to kind of guess and shout it out. And then I play the song, and they're always sing along type songs. So everybody starts singing. I was like, and out of every crowd, I thought leadership, they're going to be stuffy with their suits. No, they were jamming out to Journey and Alicia Keys. I mean, it was funny. And immediately, that's the first 5 minutes. So then I've got them, right? Now I've got to probe them a little bit and get them, provoke them a little bit to get them to think differently about what they're doing with AI in their schools. And so I've disarmed them, and now I want to bring them in. But again, totally different attack styles there, because one is a room of 400, one is a room of 12. So I don't have time to tell my story to them. So I used to do that a lot early in my career too. Like I'll spend the first 5-10 minutes talking about what I do for a living, but what I've learned over time is like, they'll get that throughout the conversation. You don't need to say, and I've done this and I've done that, and here are my kids. And every now and then I'll show my kids, but for the most part, it's like, it's intertwined with what the message is.
Well, talk to us through your preparation for all of this. You know, are your slides busy? Or is it one word? Is it just pictures? Obviously you mentioned that you're changing things on the fly. How much of what you're doing is ad lib because you know this stuff, and how much of it is, okay, I can change this as I go?
It depends on the session, of course, because I have improv sessions too that are almost 100% ad lib. And those are actually, be honest, my favorite, because I have no idea what's going to happen. And it's called Fail Fest. And it's, the idea is I have 10% of it scoped out, where I'm going to say, okay, guys, we're going to do this now. We're going to do this now. And then it's what the audience does is how I react. Those I love, because I'm always on my toes. But for the most part on those keynotes, it's going to be 90% solidified, practiced, rehearsed. I do a timing drills the day before. So I'll, in my hotel room, like let's say I'm traveling somewhere to get a keynote, I'll sit there and go through my slides. I've done it enough now where I don't do the whole thing live rehearsal, but I will. For early on in my career, I did a lot of practice in front of a mirror. I would sit there with my clicker, have it, if I could plug it into the TV screen in the hotel room, that's great. I just have it on my laptop, and I would walk through and pace my timing, hold for laughter here, hopefully, you know, that kind of things, right? And just pace it. And then I'd start a timer and I would keep myself going. And I got through that, I was able to kind of figure out, okay, this is going to take me 5 minutes. This is going to take me 7. This little interactive thing I'm going to have them do is going to take them 3. And if I do enough audience call outs, then maybe it'll take an extra minute or two, but it'll be worth it. So I try to give myself some buffer room there, but you could ask my wife, I always hit, like, I've gotten better over the last couple of years, but I usually go over time. She's like, God, you have a lot of words. she has to listen to them for free. For me, it's I try to practice my routines down. And so a lot of that. The other thing I do that's the last few years that I do is I try to get there early so I can see the space. If possible, I like to see it the night before, the day before, the morning of, whatever, so I can see it, because I like to do a lot of visualization. So I want to imagine the crowd. I want to imagine myself. How am I going to be walking around the crowd, walking off the stage, doing whatever? I always do. It's almost it's not an OCD thing. It's more of a nerve thing for me. I like my anxiety. I want to be able to see, okay, what kind of room am I dealing with? There's always going to be something thrown at you where the connection doesn't work, or in one case, my laptop just would not project. And so I'm like, okay, how do I do a 60-minute keynote when I prepared 162 slides and now I have no slides? Like, those kind of things happen, but rarely. Usually it's because I try to prepare, practice, and have backup plans always. So always have everything backed up. No problem. I'll just put it on my iPad and connect that now. It's not going to be as great, but at least I still have my content. And to go back to your other point about content, it's mostly visual. There are some videos, but there's not a lot. There are some words, but not a lot. It's mostly me narrating a story for you. Like, you're watching a movie and I'm narrating it. And then you're participating in part of the narration.
What is your slide deck of choice these days?
I've tried all of them. I used to be a PowerPoint guy. And then in 2012, I gave it up for Lent. As a kind of a joke,
a long line.
And then I fell in love with Keynote Apple's Keynote, and just never went away from it. I did Google Slides for a little bit too. I tried that. I still do somewhat, But for me, it's Keynote. I've gotten to where I can do it so fast, and I can do so many animations and proprietary magic tricks, I'll just call them that, where I can make the slides do stuff to where we have a running joke, a lot of us in the speaker circuit. It's like, you know, you've hit a point when they come up to you and say like, oh, that was a great story, there's a great session. But what's funny is a lot of times someone will come up and say, hey, that was great, good job. What kind of slides were you using? What was the software? And I was like, so you missed my entire message, but you love the delivery. Or what was that clicker you're using that does a little spotlight thing? And I'm like, it's a running joke, but I'm like, oh, did you get anything out of the message? Like, oh yeah, I did, but I just gotta know, like, how did you make your slides?
Oh, I hope you get this reference. I'm sorry to anybody listening who this might not make any sense. 2012 Adam Bellow.
Yes.
I'm drawing a blank after that. It was an ISTE or someplace else, but he something on his Apple Keynote slide that had like the Okay, so go back and listen to the last couple episodes when I had Adam on. This was back in January. I'm talking to the listeners in their car right now, but I know he and I talked about it. And it was, you know, Adam came out, did this whole speech, and like, but his keynote was actually set up to do captions, I think it was what it was. And he had everything going at the same time.
So, he's auto-tweeting.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right, the auto-tweeting, that's what it was. Yes, the auto-tweeting. So yes, trying to figure out all those technical things. And I think you and I had talked about this, or I was around you when this was mentioned at FETC this year.
Yeah.
Every major keynoter was using Canva for the first time. No Google, no Microsoft, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, that shift kind of happened I've seen it slowly over the last couple, 3 years, but you know what? I've become more aware of it. And of course with me, I'm always like, okay, am I missing something here? Like, is this a blind spot that I need to make sure that I'm covering? And I do a lot of stuff with Canva, but not slides yet. So I do like the interactivity of it. And I see a lot of them, you know, they proudly kind of take their phone and just start driving from their phone, right? While they have their laptop connected, and they do little push pulls. And
yeah,
I love all that interactivity. So for me, I need to play with it more, to be honest. I'm still a slide design geek. So if I could start there, and I know I could do a lot of great design in Canva, but it's just a matter of learning the tools faster. And efficiency also plays a role.
Well, let's take a look at all of this stuff here, because when it comes to presenting and slides and audience sizes, the one thing that every presentation has is that little goodie bag at the end, right? And, you know, we're sitting here on TeacherCast trying to put together our TeacherCast University stuff. And, you know, everything I design is on the website and log in, and I've got it, you know, convert kitted. I know you're using convert kit too. You know, where if you want to come to my presentation, give me your email address, that gets you onto the page. Talk to us about being in the audience for a Carl Hooker presentation. If you're going to be showing something, is it built off your website? Is it built off an email address? Are you doing any email marketing in there? How do I know that I'm getting the thing that you want me to get for a workshop or a speech? What does that back end look like for you?
And Jeff, this is something that I probably failed at completely the first 10 or 12 years of speaking, and I wish I would have picked up on it sooner. And I saw people doing it, and I was like, oh, that's a great idea. And I never kind of enacted on it. And I just really in earnest started this year. So even for those of you listening out there, again, I mean, always learning, always growing, always trying to figure out how to get better. We should all be doing that. And for me, my marketing or my after speech kind of, I was just like, oh, here's a link. Just take it all. You know, I don't mind giving it all away. Don't get me wrong. But what I wasn't doing is what you were just talking about, which was any type of lead gen or lead capture. So starting in the fall of last year, I create a good friend of mine, Felix Giacomino. If you don't know him, he's in Miami. For Christmas about 10 years ago, he gave me a URL shortener, my own personal one. This is, by the way, what a nerd I am, right? This is like a great gift. Like, hey, Carl, here's your own personal URL shortener, MrHook.it. And what I could do on the back end of that is I can create, you know, short links that I could see the people who's clicking on it, QR codes, all of this stuff. And in the case of writing books, when you put a QR code or any type of link in, and if a link goes dead 3 years later, you can go back and change the back end of the link, because the link in the book is going to be the same. So all that to say, I have these links, and I was like, all right, at the end of every session, I was like, all right, just go to this link, mrhook.it/FETC or mrhook.it/ISTE or whatever. And then I realized, I was like, you know what, this is taking a lot. And every time, what would happen is, on occasion, if I'm really doing a lot of sessions over the course of a week or so, let's say I'm going to 4 different places in a week, I would miss sometimes, and as a perfectionist in me would hate it, but I would have the wrong link at the bottom of the end of my slides. And so I switched all that to where it's just mrhook.it/resources, and that's it. every slide is always going to be that at the end. And what happens is on the back end of that, it takes them to a very simple Google survey, Google form, where they pull in their name and their email, and then basically, like, where do they see me? And then anything else. Oh, a little checkbox I add in there. Do you want more information about bringing Carl to your district or event or not? I don't care. But, you know, if you want to put that in there, that's great. And so they do, and then they send it in, and then instantly it auto-generates to their email a link to all my – then it goes to my website, carlhooker.com, with a specific one of that session with all the PDFs of everything I've done. I don't do keynotes because there's huge files, and also not everybody has Keynote. And I have a lot of weird proprietary fonts, so it looks real funky. So I save them as PDFs, but I don't care. They can take the slides at that point. And also, it saves me from getting spammed or like attacked. It's having that layer of protection to me was like a good excuse to like do it. But then the back end of it, of course, the residual is, of course, now I know that, oh, there's all these people that got the information, which is great. And I've got maybe a handful that say, hey, they want some more information. So my wife and I run kind of a husband, wife, you know, mom and pop shop here. I don't work for any big speaking firms. So she'll follow up with them and say, hey, you know, a couple of weeks out, she's like, hey, I noticed you checked the box that you wanted more information. What would you like? No, here's a few things that he does. And some of those, you know, bear fruit and some of them don't. But think about all the times for the last 10 or 12 years where I would get a business card or something, and then it would stick it in my jacket pocket. And then a month later, I'm like, oh, I was supposed to reach out to, you know, so much lost work because I just wasn't optimizing my own follow through. And I think that's something that I wish, if you're just getting started, have that tight and have that nailed down when you go out there. And at first I struggled with it because I felt like I don't want to be disingenuous, but I'm also like, this is also the work I do. So trying to be, you know, honest with people, like, hey, when you do this, I'll sign you up. You're going to be on my newsletter, but honestly, I don't send it out a lot. And when I do, it's usually good stuff. It's free things, or like I host a lot of regional events with Tech and Learning. So if you want a free 2-night hotel stay somewhere and I'm in that region, I can hook you up. And that's when people get excited. And it's true. I do. I blast those out all the time. Like, hey, I'm going to be in Boston in next week, I think. And I'm like, hey, if you want to come to the summit, there's a couple spots. They have some VIP openings for a hotel, and they'll give you a free hotel room. And so for me, I'm being honest about it when I do it. I don't want to be like, hey, just put in your name and email. Trust me, you know, and I don't spam people either because I hate getting spammed myself. So I'm not going to do that to people. But yeah, that's a great question, Jeff. Something that I think, you know, again, I didn't improve on. I learned a lot from Monica Burns on that front because she's a huge ConvertKit person, and she spent a half hour of her time. She didn't have to with me just showing me the ropes of ConvertKit and how it works. And I still probably don't use it to its, you know, I probably use 10% of it.
Talking today to Carl Hooker all about the great stuff that he's doing, not only on the stage, but off the stage. And Carl, obviously we can spend a lot more time talking about books and education and AI. But as I mentioned earlier, this show was actually crowdsourced. I had to ask a lot of people, what would they talk to you about if they could get you on a show for half an hour? And these were some of the topics, but I did have one particular listener, a very casual fan of TeacherCast, actually write a number of questions that they wanted to have answered from Carl Hooker. Would you be interested can I focus on one person's questions?
Yeah, rapid fire. You want to do it rapid fire? You want me to go in depth? How do you want me to, how fast on these?
Well, I want to make sure that this particular person here is getting everything that they need out of this particular list of questions. These questions actually came from Bedford, Massachusetts. I don't know the exact full name, but it was a D, an M, and then a J. DMJ, I think, is the initials
here.
Was
there an X in there somewhere, too?
It was an X. There was a factor. Something was going on in there. I didn't get the whole email, but I do have some
for you. Okay. Oh boy, let's go.
Would you be okay with this?
Let's do it. I'm sure. Right. I mean, I can only imagine what that DMXJ might ask me.
So the first question here was, you used to be a first grade teacher. You said you were working with six-year-olds.
Yep.
Was it fun doing conferences while making sure that parents could fit in those little chairs?
You know, that was one of the most interesting things. This was the most eye-opening thing of teaching that I didn't discover until I became a parent. And it was the moment when little, I won't say his name, we'll call him Johnny because that's kind of the general one, who was an absolute terror, but I somehow corralled, I guess, or got him to work and do things and motivated him. When that parent would sit in those tiny little chairs and say, how do you get my son to do anything? Because I can't get him to do anything in my house. And I'm like, you know, I'm just really good. And then I had kids and I realized, like, oh my gosh, they just don't pay attention to anything you say as a parent, is what I should have said to them. But at the time I was like, yeah, I'm tooting my own horn here. But yeah, no, that was great. I had some very interesting interactions with parents, and And I actually had one ask me out on a date, believe it or not, which I don't think is public knowledge. I mean, my wife knows about it. I just gotten married too, which is funny because I didn't have a wedding ring on, but I just gotten back from getting married. Like literally the weekend after I got married, I came back and this woman came up and handed me her number, a parent. And it was like my last day of school. And she was embarrassed to do it during the school year. And I was like, oh, that's so sweet. I go, but, and I went to reach for it and showed her the ring. She's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And she walked off. And I was like, oh, you know, that was funny. And of course I got home right away and told my, guess what? Somebody wanted to ask me out on a date. She's like, shut up. That's not worth it. Stop it.
All right, question number two. How has presenting across the country given you a broader perspective in your coaching?
I think for me, it's been that be more focused and more genuine when it comes to where you're at. In other words, don't just do generic, I can be anywhere USA. I saw Bill Gates do this once horribly at South by Southwest. There's a line of teachers waiting to get up to watch him. Obviously, he's a closing keynote at South by, so everyone wants to come see it. And all my teachers were with me. And he gets up on stage and he starts talking about, at the time, Common Core was really making the way around. And of course, in Texas, famously, you know, we're not Common Core. We do our own thing, which looks just like Common Core, but we call it our own thing. And he got up on stage and he was talking about how important Common Core was. And he shows this giant map of the United States. He's like, these are all the states that have bought into this. And there's a huge grayed out Texas right in the middle. And the crowd starts laughing. And he isn't intending it as a joke. He turns to actually look at his slides because he thought maybe like something had happened on his slides, or he didn't know where he was. And for me, that was an eye-opening moment. I was like, wow. And my teachers actually turned to me like, what? And it turned out to be a big pitch for whatever he was in Bloom or whatever his thing was that he was trying to pitch that time for education. And so my teachers like, and I walked out. But I was like, man, always know your audience, know where you're at, do a little bit of legwork. Tom Murray always would show me some things where he would follow up and ask like, what's the mascot? Tell me a little bit about some of your, do you have famous alumni? Is there somebody there that's done something notable? Or is there a teacher that's had some sort of moment or some sort of impactful thing that I could call out? And using those moments to say like, listen, I know where I'm at. I'm putting your logo on my slide. I know that this is also like your mission, you know, which are kind of almost the same in every school, to be honest, but at least changing it a little bit to whatever the mission is, tying into that, putting in that little bit of extra effort. It goes a long way because teachers will know, they'll remember like, okay, this person at least knows where they're at and they know. So whenever I do a pre-work with a school or a district where I'm coming, I always ask like, what are the initiatives that you're doing? What are your, what are your devices look like? If I'm going to talk about iPads and you've got nothing but Chromebooks, that's silly of me, right? Or if I'm going to talk about this great Google Workplace, but you're on Microsoft, then I just totally bombed and lost the audience. So learning a little bit about the audience, whatever it is that they're doing, I think is important. So for me, that's my big takeaway.
Third question here. With all that you do and share, where do you go for your learning and why is it X Factor?
Wow. Well, you know, X Factor is just the number one place to go for all learning. Let's just say that. Where is that check at? Did he send it to me? Never mind. I can't say it. Retract that. No. I go to a lot of different places. I honestly, where if I had to do it on a pie chart and say, okay, where is my all the 100%? I would say probably right now in my life, 70-ish% comes from colleagues, conversations, communication, talking to each other at conferences, following each other on social media, texting each other. I mean, I'm in great group. I have some great, amazing text threads. And a lot of it's just, you know, gibberish and stuff that's just for fun. But every now and then we'll drop in something that's like, wow, that's interesting. Let me try that out. Or has anyone seen or tried this or those kind of things? So I say 70% of it comes from that. And then the other 30% comes from podcasts and books and kind of more traditional, I would say, learning tools. I haven't done like an online course in a while, but right when the pandemic started, I did a bunch of those, just kind of beef up on things. And of course, seeking out my own learning is part of all of that, right? So YouTube is a big favorite. TikTok sometimes now more than ever, starting to use more of that, especially when it comes to making really good salads in 45 seconds or less. But it's all out there. But yeah, I think for me, it's self-motivated and it's also through my connections now because I feel like I spent 15 years really curating this huge group of people that I'm connected with. And it's like, why not lean on them? And I share it back whenever I can. I try to make it sort of reciprocal. I don't want to be that friend that's just like, help me with this. No, I will help you too whenever you need it.
All right, I got three more questions. He wanted to know a lot here.
So man, he's really this MJ, what X, whatever. He really wants to know a lot.
All right, next one here. What is your advice to educators looking to take that step to be an author or a presenter?
I think in the words of Nike, just do it. Is that right? Oh, can we say that, or is that trademarked? No, I think for me, and I going back to our very beginning conversation, Jeff, it's like going out and practicing. So practice in your own district, get in front of your own staff. You know, hey, principal, you're going to have an after school meeting in the library. Can I have 5 minutes to share like a crazy idea or something that I'm doing with my students? And just practicing that part of it. The other thing, the other side of that, the book part of that is to also know that everything you're doing, I think everybody should write a book, honestly. I think there's a lot of things that you're all doing in your everyday life that you can easily capture, write down, and that could be usable to someone else out there. Or even if it's not, it's still usable to you. So the practice of reflection and writing is so powerful. I've learned so much in writing books. Almost more so than reading them in some ways. Like, wow, I really didn't think I was doing this right. But when I went back and studied it and kind of figured out how to write it for an audience, I was like, okay, it helped me codify a lot of what I was doing. So I would say as a teacher, if you're wanting to write, just start. And my strategy, everyone's different. I'll tell you mine really quick. It's I brainstorm, like if a topic is X, I want to have 100 different ideas underneath that topic. Just brainstorm, like here's some things I could talk about. All right, now let me get like an outline over here. Okay, now these topics will filter under this part of the chapter, and then you have your chapters kind of figured out. And then I go and write out the chapters and say, okay, what was I going to write about this chapter? Oh yeah, some of these ideas that I had moved over. So then making sure the ideas form, and then there's some sort of takeaway on each. So that's after writing 8 books, that's kind of like my fast and furious method. The last one took me 4 weeks, but before that, it was taking, I was doing about every 3 months, I was trying to churn out a book.
And who published those last 2 books?
It was I think it was X Factor.
2 more questions for you. I don't understand this question, so I'm going to read it exactly how it was written to me.
This is scary.
I saw a session that you and Matt Joseph did in Utah about Street Fighter. How did that come about, and what was the purpose? Please give us that story.
So, to back up to the 8-minute mark of this podcast, when we started talking about what makes people engaged,
was there costumes?
There were not physical costumes, but I did use AI to generate some imagery. Let's just say that on the screen.
Okay.
Anybody that was a kid in the 80s, 90s, played a lot of Street Fighter, maybe got some sore fingers and thumbs from playing with the hands and the joystick or whatever, the buttons. So I recreated, we decided we're going to do a kind of a, originally it was going to be a would you rather, but more of a debate, like a point counterpoint, I think was the title of the session. And so we put out the session months ago without really filling in what it was going to look like delivery wise. And as we started going through, I was like, well, we could just do kind of, you could say this and I could say this. And how do we get the audience involved? And then it became, well, let's start street fighting. And so I think it was like 2 weeks before, he was like, well, we've got to come up with something. So I sent him just like the image of the Street Fighter thing. He's like, yes. And so I got into Keynote, and then I spent the next several hours like buried, just like playing with animation. So we'd fly up on the screen and the word fight would come out, round two, fight. And I even found the original sound bites. And it was both of us, a Street Fighter character, our heads on Street Fighter characters changed the way we looked, everything about, but it was still our faces. And then that would bring out the topic, which then had a 1-minute timer. So we each had a debate, and then the audience decided where they fell on either side of the topic. And then wherever the audience agreed with the most, that's who got the point. And their health points would go up or down based on that, and knockout, you know, those kind of things. Finish him, although that's Mortal Kombat. But awesome. Yeah, anyway, so that's how it started, and that's how it. And at the end, it was awesome. Unfortunately, it was on the last day. You know how it is, the last day of a conference.
Right.
It was on the last day in a little room somewhere. So about 22 people got to see it, and they were loving every minute of it. But it would be great to do on a big stage, too.
This is not part of the. There's one more question here from this anonymous source, but
okay.
Have you ever put in a lot of time on a session like that, and you're really interested in doing it, and then you didn't get it, like it wasn't accepted?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, either it wasn't accepted because I pitched it and they didn't take it, or as a conference, which happens, I pitch a lot of stuff that doesn't get accepted. Even at ISTE, I know I've been there forever, done a lot of stuff, and I work with ISTE on a podcast, and they published my first 6 books, but they reject a lot of my stuff because I have some weird ideas, and they're not all great, folks. I'm going to be honest. I have a lot of ideas, and most of them are bad, is what I say. But the worst is when you do, yeah, you spend time and energy and effort on something, and then you go to a district, let's say, and I do a keynote, and then they have breakout sessions, but then they say, okay, well, we also have mandatory this. So you're going to get, you know, whatever out of these 4 left, you know, basically, so you get 3 people in your room. And I always have fun with those, but I'm also kind of like, man, I spent a good amount of time preparing for this. And they always, what's funny is they'll come back, and sometimes the organizers are like, oh, we're sorry, we apologize. I was like, you know what? I enjoy working with anybody. And be honest, I'm already here. You're paying me. It could be one person or it could be no people. I mean, I'm still going to be here for you. So and I'm always just appreciative of the people that spend the time. But yeah, there's a little bit of disappointment there.
I have done the Iron Chef Google Workspace for 150 people. And then you're in a room where there's two people and you're ready to go on with this concept. And you're just like,
I can't. Oh, this is gonna
fall. I can't do this.
You can't. You have to change it right on the fly. It's not gonna work.
No. All right. You do this and you, and they're like, no,
no,
no, we're not.
Two people and that's it. The audience of none. Yeah.
All right, I got one more question here. I don't understand where this is going to come from. So again, I'm going to need a little bit of help here. I'm going to read it exactly where this is. Carl Hooker, if you were given a brand new Apple laptop, but you had to wear a Dallas Cowboys shirt to do a keynote, would you do it?
1,000% never.
Oh,
never, never, ever. Never, ever, ever. I'm an Eagles fan. Go Birds through and through. I am one of a few in the middle of the state of Texas. I get stuff thrown at me when my truck has Eagles gear on it, and it's got all sorts of scratches and dents, and people throw things at it, and I don't care. There's no way. It would take a lot for me to put on a Cowboys jersey. In fact, one of my daughters recently said, well, Dad, what if I like the Cowboys? I was like, well, you can just move out. I mean, you're 12. You can just live somewhere else. So no.
13 years, Carl, you are now my favorite guest of all time. I will
ring the bell.
I will take anybody. Right. No, not that.
That would be the worst guest of all time.
All right, hey, there we go. Yeah, anybody who's going to come on and talk good about the Eagles and bash the cat from Texas, I will have on the show as much as I possibly can. Carl, where can we go to find out more information about the great and wonderful stuff that you're doing?
You can find me at EAGLES. No, that's not that. .com. No, carlhooker.com is my website. Hookedoninnovation.com is my blog. I'm at Mr. Hooker on Twix, because I won't call it Twitter or X. And at Hooker Tech on Insta and TikTok, thanks to the 15-year-old daughter for pushing me to do reels more often. So I'm working on that too. So at Hooker Tech.
Check out all the great stuff over at carlhooker.com. We're going to make sure that we have a complete lineup of show notes with links to everything that we've been talking about. Carl, let's do this again. Thank you so much for coming on today.
We didn't even get a chance to talk about the bar, Jeff. Next time.
Who's taking the bar?
That's a different kind of bar, but yes, that's what we call a teaser in the business, folks. Thank you, Jeff, for having me.
All right. Thank you guys so much. And if you guys are looking to be a guest on this show, please head on over to teachercast.net/podcast for not only our Jeff Bradbury show, Digital Learning Today, and also Ask the Tech Coach, and coming back, our Educational Podcasting Today show, where you guys can learn how to create a podcast of your own. Check out everything over at teachercast.net/podcast. And on behalf of Carl and everybody here on TeacherCast, my name is Jeff Bradbury, reminding you guys to keep up the great work in your classrooms and continue sharing your passions with your students.
Go Birds.
You've been listening to the TeacherCast Educational Network, hosted by Jeff Bradbury. Please reach out to the show with all of your questions on Twitter at TeacherCast or online at www.teachercast.net. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. And please take a moment to write a review in the App Store.